Good evening, everyone. On behalf of your three sponsors, the Fulbright Association of New Hampshire, World Affairs Council of New Hampshire, and UNH Manchester, I'm delighted to welcome all of you here for another Tipping Point program. I'd like to just say a few things about Fulbright, which is the largest international exchange program, and it's over 70 years old. And in fact, our founder, Senator Fulbright, today would be his birthday, and his idea was to make peace. If people talk, you can create understanding. And that's how the association really, and Fulbright program itself started. The Fulbright Association is an independent organization that promotes the Fulbright program itself. And under Fulbright, there are over 20 different programs. So whether you're an academic, a doctor, a nurse, a farmer, if you have some specialty, there are all kinds of programs. And we have on the table over there list of some of the programs that are there and links to finding out about them. On the 18th of this month at the other UNH campus in Durham, we will be sponsoring a program, a conversation with Senator Jean Shaheen, and she will be interviewed by Professor Jeannie Sowers, who is the head of the International Center there. We think it's going to be a dynamic program looking at Congress and international affairs and how U.S. government conducts its international affairs. Again, it's a free program. We have flyers on the seats and on the table about it. I would next like to introduce the president of the World Affairs Council, Steve Solomon, who would like to say a couple of words also. Always good to see you, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. As Ann said, my name is Steve Solomon. I'm the president of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire, and I'd like to welcome you to this evening's program. The caveat is the council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization, so the views expressed by our speaker tonight are not necessarily those of the council, its members, or its board of trustees. I'd like also to thank our sponsors, the New Hampshire chapter of the Fulbright Association, UNH Manchester's Homeland Security, History, Humanities, and Politics and Society programs, and I'd like to extend a special thank you and welcome to our members of the council who are attending here tonight. And hopefully those of you who are not members will feel inspired to become members afterwards, and at the table on the way out, we have membership information for you. It is with the support of our members that the council is able to present this and our other programs. And speaking of other programs, we have a special speaker coming on May 19th at our global forum, David Sanger. It's probably well known to many of you. He is the national security correspondent for the New York Times, the best-selling author, and he will be talking about his book on cybersecurity and social media and politics. Tonight, we are honored to have as our speaker Elizabeth Brown, who brings a wealth of experience from the media, nonprofit, government, and academic sectors. From 2013 to 2016, she was the executive director of the United States Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy, which is a body authorized by Congress to oversee and promote United States government activities that understand, inform, and influence foreign publics. Most recently, she was a public policy manager at Facebook. Must have been challenging.
Well, it's not a talk.
and also in residence as a council, as residence in the Council of Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. She holds a PhD and MA in communications from Columbia University and a BA from George Washington University. In April of last year, she became the CEO of Global Ties US, an organization which for over 50 years is a nonprofit partner of the United States Department of State, sustains a network, including the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire, that coordinates international exchange programs and brings current and future leaders from around the world to communities throughout the United States. So Elizabeth is the author of a book, which will be available for sale and signature after the program, About Your Country, Our War, the Press and Diplomacy in Afghanistan, which describes how U.S. media has shaped perceptions about the war in Afghanistan to people within and outside the country. So she'll be available after our talk to sign copies of her book, as I said, which will be available for sale. So please welcome Elizabeth Brown. Sorry about that. Do I know Elizabeth Brown?
I don't know if my mom wanted to name me Elizabeth. Okay, so well, she's listening. Close. This is music to her ears. Hi, everyone. I'm Catherine. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm happy I got here on time. I was driving up from Providence, and suddenly there was hail and rain and New England springtime weather. So I'm happy I made it. And I just wanted to thank Steve and thank Tim for having me here. This is actually the second time I've visited Manchester. I first got here in August, spent some time with Tim to hear what was on his mind. Global Ties US, which is the organization I've been running for a year as of today, actually, is honored to have a network of 85 nonprofit organizations across the country to help to facilitate international exchange programs, particularly one called the International Visitor Leadership Program, which I love Senator Fulbright, and happy birthday, Senator Fulbright, and I love the Fulbright program, but IVLP is about 10 years older. It's 80 years old, the longest public diplomacy program that the U.S. government has been running. And as mentioned already, what it strives to do is find the best and the brightest around the world in a host of different professions and bring them to the United States to make sure that they have a three-dimensional view of the country, that they build empathy for the United States, but also build a professional cohort amongst their American peers and with each other, the group they're traveling with, to make sure that we're building constituencies abroad, that people who understand America and help it its foreign policies advance. The biggest indicator of its success that we like to say is that more than 500 current and former heads of state had been on this program. So it really does help us build lasting ties with the world's emerging leaders. And its exchange programs were always dear to my heart. I was an exchange student in high school. I was one in college. And in pretty early into my career, I started going and working abroad, and that's kind of where my story for you tonight begins. I wrote this book that came out about a month ago, Your Country, Our War, about the press and diplomacy in Afghanistan, because about 16 years ago, I was an aide to Condoleezza Rice and Steve Hadley in the White House, and it was around the time that we were going to war in Iraq, and it was post 9/11. I was a student of international relations in the 90s. I learned, you know, that about Cold War, and that the world was kind of neatly in this bipolar era, and then suddenly 9/11 happens, and as a young professional, everything we knew was kind of turned on its head. And I was very fortunate to be able to work for the National Security Advisor and Deputy National Security Advisor, but became very curious about these post 9/11 wars that we were now in by 2003 with Afghanistan and now Iraq. I got the opportunity to go to Kabul and be a press aide at the U.S. Embassy in 2003. And at the time, I'm not sure how many of you remember what a good news story Afghanistan was. It was a quick success. There was never a mission accomplished moment in Afghanistan like there was with Iraq, or at least one that was created for Afghanistan. It was, but there was a lot of good news, right? It was a war born of 9/11. It had a clear mandate. It was a war that 97% of the public agreed with, that overwhelmingly Congress supported, and which our troops advanced, our special forces, and then our troops advanced pretty quickly. The Taliban fell, you know, from Kabul and then Kandahar by the end of 2003, and suddenly there was these stories of incredible hope that emerged. Women who were able to take off their burqas, children who were, young girls who were able to go to school, you know, a society that had been oppressed long by the Taliban, which could now kind of live out in the open. And that story then changed. And so when I got there, we were still kind of riding on that story of hope. And there's a memory that I have of early December 2003, when we were supporting the Constitutional Loya Jirga, which was a grand assembly. That's literally what Loya Jirga means in Dari, and it brought delegates from across the country to forge the first democratic constitution in Afghanistan's history. We were really eager as embassy press aides to tell this story, but the media, the broadcast journalists who had spent some time in Afghanistan at that point, had shifted their focus to Iraq, the most covered war in American history, media-wise. And so we decided at the embassy that it was a good idea to get some satellite time and show America, you know, how good things were still going in Afghanistan. Maybe things in Iraq weren't going so well, but in Afghanistan they were. So we brought President Karzai in for an interview with Tom Brokaw, and we set up kind of mini bare bones television studio and sat President Karzai down and put a feed in his ear so you could hear Tom Brokaw in New York, which was about 9.5 hours behind where we were in Kabul. And they had an interview about how well things were going. And at the time, Karzai really embodied this sense of elegance, right? He was a unifier, he was a credible partner. He was voted, I think, the most elegant man, like one of the best dressed men in the world by Esquire magazine. And we really held him up as his hero. And that interview went exceedingly well. It was about all the progress that had been made. My time in Afghanistan, the rest of my time at the embassy, was essentially about this story of progress, where Karzai was still this figure of hope, where things were getting better. That narrative didn't last very long. And what I became an astute observer about was the stories that we were telling, American press was telling, about Afghanistan, but also about the world, and how they were traveling back to the countries that were being talked about. And how did the stories that we tell ourselves as Americans, how we make sense of the world as Americans, how does that land in countries where we have some vital interests? If you think to where you think about Karzai now, and where how he is depicted in the American press, it's very different from that picture of 2003, where he was a trusted figure. He left office in 2014, very skeptical of the United States power, lashing out constantly about Western media, the U.S. media, and also BBC, so CNN, BBC, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Reuters. He was constantly upset with the way in which Afghanistan was being covered. And the way it was being covered was the way in which our press normally talks about the world, in the sense that it puts America at the center, first of all. Much of the way we read about the United States and read about foreign affairs in United States media is very U.S.-centric, and that's for good reason. It's to resonate with American audiences. He was also frustrated with the frames in which U.S. journalists were choosing to depict his country. One was, of course, the security frame that we understand the country through a lens of war, that the main kind of heroes and archetypes that we look to in news stories about Afghanistan are about soldiers, right? They're about our troops, they're about our diplomats, about the welfare of American citizens in the country. And so, of course, that's going to lend itself towards a story about conflict. And the other major frame, essentially, is about what a failed state Afghanistan is. It's a story of stories of corruption, of stories of how taxpayer dollars are being spent, you know, wisely or unwisely, but really this kind of overarching story of corruption that definitely haunted President Karzai. And the third part is that it's again that by putting America kind of at the center, is this idea that the world is dependent on America. And that is what frustrated him the most as well, because the stories that were being created by US journalists were not that they had power in the same way that we have military and economic power in the world. Our journalists have incredible amount of power to shape the identities and fix those identities on the world stage. So he knew that the American press had an incredible amount of power over fixing perceptions, global perceptions, about his country, his people, and his family. So by the time Karzai left office, he strongly believed that US journalists, the same ones that used to celebrate his elegance and his ability to be a real change maker, that these same journalists were actually agents of the US government, that they were working closely and at the direction of the US government to undermine his rule, to undermine democratic progress, with the purpose for the United States to stay in Afghanistan indefinitely, to keep it under its thumb. And part of this is the idea that amongst many, many Afghans that I've spoken with during my research, that which you know, went on for nearly a decade there, that they can't believe that a country with the kind of power, the material power the United States has, would actually not have already won this conflict. Why has it taken more than 17 years? Why are we mired in this debate, you know, this negotiation with the Taliban right now? If the US, as powerful and as strong as it is, wanted to win this conflict, it could have. So why hasn't it yet? It must have a larger agenda. It must want to colonize the country. And so President Karzai didn't want to be the president who would allow for that. So as one of his last acts as president in August 2014, he kicked out a New York Times reporter, Matthew Rosenberg. And that's how the book begins. Now, when you talk to Matt Rosenberg and you talk to his editors at the Times, the story that he was kicked out over wasn't really a big deal. In 2014, there was another presidential race. Who would succeed President Karzai after his two terms and his term as interim president. And so there was a race, and the two top contenders were Ashraf Ghani, the current president, and Abdullah Abdullah, the current CEO. And that is because this race never really did have a clear victory, and this compromise was created in part by Secretary of State John Kerry at the time. So there was a stalemate in August 2014, and what the New York Times and Matt Rosenberg wrote was a story that, in his view, was so obvious, it just hadn't been reported yet. And it was that the Afghan elites were so nervous that there wasn't going to be a clear victory. And of course there wasn't. There later had to be this engineered compromise. But they were so nervous there wasn't going to be a clear victory that there had to be some kind of interim government set up. And the biggest concern that they had was that they wanted the interim government to sign the bilateral security agreement with the United States so that US troops could remain in the country. Karzai didn't want the bilateral security agreement for that same reason I cited, that he felt that it would subject his country to prolonged some kind of neocolonialism of the United States. But Abdullah and Ghani did want the bilateral security agreement. They felt like it was in the best interest of security of their country. They knew that Afghan national security forces need the mentorship and support of American security forces. But in order for American security forces to remain, they had to have immunity, you know, from the Afghan government. That was part of what this bilateral security agreement was. So there was talk of this coup. Not really a coup, it was like more like a soft coup. But if you wanted to look at it from Karzai's perspective, it was a coup. So Matt Rosenberg filed this story. It wasn't on the front page of the New York Times. It wasn't really headline news in America in August 2014. The lead story was more about, you know, ongoing conflict in Syria and kind of the rise of ISIL. But Karzai was enraged because he felt that this was a story directed by the U.S. government in order to undermine his successful rule and his successful support of a democratic transition in the country, and to undermine a successful transition, that there wouldn't be a clean victory, a democratic, you know, a clean democratically elected president, that this was U.S. meddling somehow again. And Matthew Rosenberg was persona non grata from Afghanistan. When you talk to, again, the editors and the reporters, like they were surprised this was the story that kind of broke the camel's back. But again, for Karzai, there was very much this frustration that American journalists were united in a cabal with the U.S. government to ruin his presidency. A couple years later, I got the opportunity to interview President Karzai for this book. I went back to Kabul one last time in 2016 after going there on and off for 13 years. And I asked him, because he very much supported Afghan journalism and the promotion of free speech in the country and the rise of this incredible independent press corps of Afghan journalists, which I'll speak to in a minute. So I asked him, how can you reconcile supporting a free press but kicking out the New York Times, kicking out the leading newspaper, you know, in the United States, one of their top reporters? Like, how could you do that? Was that just really exercising free speech? And he said that was not free speech. That was specifically to undermine my role. And that his biggest disappointment was what a sham American democracy was, and also that it was worse than Pravda, the press arm of the Soviet Union. Because at least with Pravda, they didn't pretend to be anything else but the propaganda arm of the Kremlin. For the New York Times and for the US independent press, what's frustrating is that they pretended to be independent. They pretended to be part of a liberal democracy. And really, they just wanted to support their government and undermine its role. So he didn't see the American press as the kind of press that he was supporting. Now, the other reason why it was so frustrating was because you had this incredible group of Afghan journalists who were rising up that looked tremendously to the American journalists as their mentors. And for a very long time, would just echo essentially whatever the Western press was writing about Afghanistan as coverage. This was for a lot of reasons. One, because there was no history of independent press in Afghanistan, and they really didn't have their opportunity to emerge until about 2002. Since then, there's about 60 television stations in Afghanistan. There's more than 100 radio stations. And about of that enormous amount, there's about five or six agencies that are truly professional by Western standards, which they want to live up to, and independent. But Karzai knew that they looked up to the American journalists. So whatever was in the American press about Afghanistan normally trickled down, was relayed to his own people. How do we kind of reconcile this, right? Like, what is true about what Karzai was saying and what wasn't? Now, again, it's true that the American press tends to focus on the United States was talking about the rest of the world. Why does this matter back for the U.S.? There's a sense of ethnocentrism in U.S. reporting. It essentially holds up the United States as a standard, that liberal democracy is the best form of government. And we inject our values of a free press, you know, of course, of human rights, which some would say are universal values. But that is at the core and at the center of the American news. And it very much is so that Karzai was a target of the American press, but not for the reasons that he thinks. It was essentially, if you talk to the foreign correspondents, it's because the Karzai regime, is the entire administration, the government, is essentially an extension of U.S. foreign policy. And billions of our taxpayer dollars were going to the success of the Afghan government. So if there was corruption, it was more because it was the U.S. journalists were playing a watchdog role, you know, on the U.S. government and its use of taxpayer dollars. It wasn't necessarily to target Karzai himself. It was them being national watchdogs for how those dollars were being spent and for why American troops were dying and why so many Americans had to go there to fight. Now, where else was Karzai right? He was right about the power that the American press had over his own press corps, and he was right about the power that it has in shaping the dynamics on the international stage. The U.S. and the British press, it can be called like a duopoly. They own most of the news wires. There's a great amount of power in which different news and columns are syndicated. You look at CNN and BBC viewership, it largely outweighs any other kind of international news agency. And so this Western worldview is dominant. And if you're writing about Afghanistan in a very negative way, then that does affect the normative environment in which major international like cooperation, major deals are negotiated. And it does affect the conversations around how much aid and continued support is given to the country. So he was right about that too. Where he wasn't right was that U.S. journalists are propaganda arms of the U.S. government. If you talk to the foreign correspondents and you talk to the U.S. officials, one of which I used to be, but I spent a lot of time in the book talking to U.S. officials and reporters, the stories about their interactions are almost, it's not comical, but it's almost funny to the point at which their relationship is mired in such mistrust, such distrust, and such frustration that you would think that they were working together. American journalists, they'll admit, do have American national interests at heart. They want what's best for America. They want to make sure that the government's being held accountable. They want to make sure that the United States is the force for good. But they're not cheerleaders for U.S. foreign policy. And if you talk to U.S. officials, they definitely don't think that they are. U.S. officials have much of the same complaints that President Karzai or other Afghan officials do. Why aren't you talking about more good news? Why didn't you talk about all the children who are now going to school in Afghanistan, or the roads that are being built, or the clinics that are being built? Why aren't you sharing more of that? They have the same frustrations, but they definitely don't see U.S. journalists, and they definitely see U.S. journalists on their side. I think where it comes down to is that we have our own sense of nationalism, that as much as we felt as if international news and the idea that we can have transnational media stations in which we can consume the news of others, as much as we thought originally like that would bring the world together, we inherently see the world through our own national lenses. It's the equipment through which we view the world. And there isn't much hope that international news can really bring the world together. You're more comfortable with the news that culturally resonates with you, in which you feel as if they're talking about a world that you're familiar with. And so it's always going to be likely that if you as Americans are reading about the United States, if we're reading about the United States through a different country, it's gonna feel a little off. And that is what frustrates so many leaders, and so many, especially in the developing world, about the news that American journalists create, is that it's very much keeping and reinforcing American power and not bringing their country into three dimension. I want to stop there because I want to, I know that's a lot, and I know I want to be able to answer some questions, but there's two things that I talk about near the end of the book where I feel as if things are shifting. One is the way in which major news outlets, American news outlets, are actually covering the world. The New York Times, is, which I cover extensively in the book, is aware that their news essentially has been U.S.-centric, and they'll admit, you know, that they fell down during the Iraq War and that they should have had more investigative foreign correspondents. Where I want to applaud them is that they're increasingly giving senior roles as foreign correspondents to journalists who are local to the countries that they're writing about. And this is absolutely the case with Afghanistan. I think he is now the senior correspondent at the Kabul Bureau, is an Afghan named Mujib Mashal. He went to high school and college in the United States, but he is Afghan, and he returned home there to be a writer about 10 years ago. And when you read Mujib's writing, which if you read a New York Times article about Afghanistan recently, I'm pretty sure it's his work, there's a stark contrast the way he writes about his country to the way a foreign correspondent would. And I don't want to dismiss foreign correspondents who are Westerners, you know, writing about foreign countries, because the sociological constraints against them are enormous. It is incredibly difficult work. And there's just some parts of society they're not going to be able to tap into if you're not a local. Mujib can bring that out. And he can really explain the cultural nuance of the country in a way in which it feels like more like feature writing than anything else. And so I applaud the Times for doing that. You also see correspondents who are spending more time in countries and regions instead of parachuting in and out. The Washington Post, the lead correspondent there, Pamela Constable, has been covering Afghanistan and Pakistan for more than 20 years. And you see that in her writing as well. And so I think that's a tremendous hope. The other area of great hope is, and this is a story you don't hear about a lot, is what I already mentioned, the Afghan journalists themselves. This is one of the most remarkable stories about the last 18 years, is that you had a cohort of young Afghans who grew up during civil war and Taliban times and felt as if they finally had a moment to make their voice known and to shape a media that reflected them. And they have grown tremendously in the last 15 years, much with, I'd like to say, with the help of U.S. Aid money, but also with the help of U.S. and other Western correspondents in the country. There's been lots of non-governmental organizations that have focused on media training, but also having a Western press cohort there for such a sustained period of time has given them the space to kind of learn from them and see them as mentors, but also to rely on them and to get news stories out where they may not feel comfortable or safe yet given their cultural norms of respecting elders and respecting certain power brokers in the country. If you have a Western correspondent who's not afraid of a warlord, not afraid of an Afghan official, able to get out a story about corruption, then often the Afghan journalists are able to repeat that story and to advance it because they have the cover of Western correspondents. I found that in my years of research that was much more prevalent early on, about 10 years ago, than it is now, because you increasingly have this cohort that's able to stand on their own. And so this book is about a lot of things. It's about the stories we tell ourselves and how they travel. It's about the diplomatic role that journalists play, that they're not just you know, independent observers of events, they're active participants in it. It's about the limitations of foreign correspondents and us trying to make sense of a post 9/11 world through this microcosm of Afghanistan. But what I hope one of the takeaways is also about this incredible group of Afghan journalists and Afghan civil society and how robust it's become. It's not something you hear because you don't hear a lot of good news, but it is real. And I think I'll end it there.
So we've got some time for some Q&A. I'm Tim Horgan, Executive Director of the World Affairs Council. Thank you again all for coming out tonight. I have written down a few questions here. So just to get the ball rolling, so we heard from Brigadier General Donald Bolduc last week. He spent a lot of time in Afghanistan himself, really focusing on peace operations. And I asked him, a lot of people are now saying that we need to deal with the Taliban in order to broker peace. What are your thoughts about this? Is this a good strategy moving forward, particularly considering how much blood, sweat, tears, treasure has gone into fighting the conflict there?
Yes, yes. It's definitely the question of the day. I think it, so I've been part of the Afghan policy community, or in and out of it, for about almost 16 years, and served different roles. I told you the story. I started there as a press aide, and then I went back and worked for a nonprofit organization that does good work there called the Asian Foundation. And then I started my PhD program and did field work in the country in and out for years. And then I went back as a Council Foreign Relations Fellow about 2.5 years ago, and that was my last trip there, to interview President Karzai, some of these journalists, and finish the book. And having that kind of long view and kind of going in and out does, you know, I'm hesitant to call myself an expert because I have friends who've consistently been working on exactly this issue for the exact same amount of time while I've been going in and out. But I will just say that I am personally very conflicted by this question. I don't envy my friends who are working on the negotiations right now. My former boss, Donald Khalilzad, is leading it. And because we are at year 18, we're going on year 18 soon, of this conflict, which again, 97% of the American public was thought was going to be over very quickly. And yet it endures. And it took a long time for the policy community to get to the point where they realized that there had to be some kind of negotiation, that the only way to end this war was just through it, right? Just to confront the Taliban. And so it took a long time to get here. I think that my biggest concern is that you hear the Mullah Baradar, the number two, the deputy Taliban leader, talking almost victoriously about kind of the way things are going and saying that this is going to be a settlement for all Afghans, but not being specific on human rights. And so it's conflicting, I think, for a lot of people, because definitely you want peace, but peace at what cost, right? And is peace going to be the same kind of peace the Taliban ushered in after the Civil War in 1996, where you know, there was warlords tearing the country apart, the Taliban came in, they were welcomed in by the Afghans, and then once they were in power, quickly turned to a really brutal role. And is that gonna resurface, and is that going to undermine kind of the note I just left on talking about the real progress that's been made? Now, the progress has been uneven, right? It's mostly in the cities. The press has done, I think, a tremendous job in working to keep their government accountable and to be better stewards of what a democracy is for the Afghan public. But they've also worked at what some consider to be a breakneck speed, right, and to really challenge traditions in a way that threatens Afghans. This is, I mean, the Taliban certainly think that, and so they targeted journalists. So I am deeply concerned, you know, about friends and colleagues and making sure that vibrancy in society continues. And I guess we just have to give more data time, but also hope that the Afghan government has more full national negotiations, because right now it's just the U.S. and the Taliban. Non-answer, sorry.
No, that's fine. So maybe a little bit easier one then. What do you see as the proper role of the media in covering foreign affairs and these foreign wars?
So I want to start by saying that I think I don't want this book to be a criticism of the foreign correspondents and the journalists, because what the most of the journalists who I cover in the book and are interviewed in it are tremendous writers. They care deeply about the country. It's one thing you'll hear about a lot of people who spent time in Afghanistan, it's just how surprised they are, how fondly they think of the country and the people, and how much it gets under their skin. The journalists are no exception. They wish they had more time to cover the country. They wish they had more time to stop and reflect on what's happening from the Afghan point of view. They simply don't have that time. If you can imagine the constraints. They're largely writing stories that they may think of but have to clear with editors, you know, who are based in the United States. They're trying to write stories that kind of peg in or index to politics in Washington and policies in Washington. And they're constantly reminded, you know, of their own foreignness, right? That they're foreigners. They rarely, do the foreign correspondents speak the languages, you know, Dari and Pashto, and the other languages spoken there. And so they're very reliant on their Afghan local journalists, their stringers and fixers, but also the journalists that report for Afghan news agencies. So I think that they that most of them do a very good job. The journalists that I think fall down and do a disservice to us are the ones that really kind of parachute in for a week, or they're traveling with a principal, they're traveling with the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or the President, and they pretend to write anything other than what that principal is saying. They're trying to write about Afghan politics or Afghan society from that narrow view. That's where I think we're done a disservice. I think that what should be happening though more and more is that if we are committed to a country in the way in which we have been with Afghanistan, is that there needs to be more time and space to feature writing. We need to really try to understand what is this place, and how can we have a deeper understanding of it as a country? Because too often what happens is when you read foreign correspondents, they get kind of the quick and dirty of what's happening in the country in conflict in particular. And you hear a lot about ancient hatreds, right? Or these are legacy conflicts which we'll never be able to make a dent in, or never be able to make an impact in. And usually that's just like a really easy crutch to try to explain a country. It's something we did a lot with the former Yugoslavia. It's something, of course, with Iraq that we saw. And there's some truth to it, but it's not as simple as that. So I think there needs to be more feature writing, and that's why I'm encouraged to see that more local reporters are getting time and space.
Okay, I know how to talk to you at almost any time. So why don't we open it up to the audience for some questions?
Can I explain one thing too that I'm going to explain up there? So the book is called Your Country, Our War, for a very simple reason. It's that when us as Americans, when we think of Afghanistan, we think war, right? If you're an Afghan and you think Afghanistan, you think your country. And it's this, you know, this duality of frames, this tension in frames, which causes a lot of, you know, the tension on the international stage as well. It's resentful. The Afghans resent the idea that this is how we think of them as anything but a war. The script is meant to be the reverse meaning in Dari and Pashto. So it says, you know, your war, our country. The biggest mistake was that we didn't really explain that when we took the cover up. So you can imagine what happened with the Afghan Twitterverse, which is very lively, when they saw a mistranslation on the cover, was that here's another Westerner who is trying to explain our country and can't even get the translation right. This book must be awful. You know, so it was a very meta kind of moment when I first saw someone put the cover up on Twitter and this like huge backlash. And it's like, no, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's what the book is about. Was, you know, that how much we get the country wrong, right? But also how differently you see Afghanistan than we do. So I forgot to mention that, but thank you.
All right, Sue and Beth.
Hi, thank you very much. Very interesting. I did some work on gender in Afghanistan for UNDP a couple years ago. And one of the things I'm interested in is, are there female journalists and how do they do their work, mm-hmm. given the constraints, social and cultural constraints on women? And then how are journalists protected? Have they been subjects of attack? And is there a connection with the Committee to Protect Journalists?
Yes, excellent questions. And thank you for asking that too. One of the book's weaknesses is that there weren't many women journalists that are featured in the book, either because they didn't want to talk with me, which if you've done gender warfare, you'll understand, or they were kept kind of from me, or just that the ones who had the most influence, you know, which is who I was going after, you know, were men. But there are some women journalists I spoke with, some of the more, what years were you there? Okay, so fairly recently. So you know like Tolo and One TV, like the more progressive Afghan television stations, which are covered a lot here in the book. Women are very much present on those stations, which has had mixed results. In a lot of ways, it's supported, you know, up-and-coming, you know, Afghan journalists for women, who they see themselves, right, in society. It's a reflection of society. So it's been encouraging for them. But also those women who have been on television and who are kind of more known are under enormous constant threat. And a lot of them have decided to kind of be more behind the scenes and to shape the news that way. So it's frustrating because in one way they're making, you know, they're still having a big influence in the progress of a civil society and a journalism, but they feel like they must do behind the scenes to protect themselves, protect their family. There is a wonderful organization in Kabul called NAI, which is essentially like Afghanistan's own community protect journalists, and they look out for Afghan journalists and making sure that they're promoting their rights. So they had a lot of say in the media law that was institutionalized under President Ghani and CEO Abdullah, and making sure that there was progressive media law, because while nominally you'd have, you know, people like President Karzai and other Afghan leaders say they protected, you know, they were for freedom of the press, many felt like it was just for show for Western donors, right? That they were saying that to get more money, but really didn't believe it. So it's really important tonight to make sure that those press groups were institutionalized. Have to give credit to President Ghani as well, because he appointed a rising star in Afghan civil society specifically to try to make sure that Afghan press groups were institutionalized. That led to Freedom House kind of a couple years ago moving Afghanistan from being not free to partly free in the freedom rankings. So NAI's had a lot of good influence there, and so has CPJ, and so has Freedom House, and so has Human Rights Watch and outside advocacy groups. I will say though that there's been an inordinate amount of Afghans who have been targeted, you know, of course by the Taliban. There was a horrific attack in January 2016 by Tolo news journalist, Tolo's number one station in the country, and it's called Amin Sunrise in Dari, where many
journalists who were going home on a shuttle bus, provided by Toledo, were killed at end of day traffic by the Taliban. They were specifically targeted. But also, journalists are targeted by cabinet members, you know, by warlords. They're under constant threat and intimidation. I mean, to be an Afghan journalist takes an incredible amount of bravery, which is why it should be applauded all the more. I hope that answers your question.
Steve, up front. Mike?
Yes.
Yeah, wait, Mike's got it.
You mentioned that Karzai was unhappy with the coverage he was getting from the American journalists because they were talking about things he didn't want other people to know about, I guess. When the Afghan journalists started to be more assertive, more at a higher profile, did they write the same sort of stories?
Yeah, they're increasingly being more assertive, specifically with the Ghani administration. So, you know, President Ghani, he was, when back to the story I was talking about, Karzai taking out Matthew Rosenberg from the New York Times. Ghani, when he, you know, became president, very eagerly, one of the first things he did was call the New York Times and welcome Matt back. Right, he wanted to send a signal that he cared about American press freedom and that he valued the U.S.-Afghan relationship. But he's also getting very frustrated with American press coverage and Afghan press coverage, which is to be expected. I mean, any dynamic in a democracy, there's going to be a lot of tension between reporters and officials. Reporters say, well, it's we're not doing our job, right, if we're not aggravating those with power. And so, as one journalist said it to me, Karzai was very frustrated with the American press because the American press went after his family. And that's kind of an important detail that's impacted the book. When Karzai tells me the story that's in chapter one about when he knew that American journalists were in a cabal with American officials, there was a news story in, I believe it was October 2004, New York Times, journalist named Carlotta Gall wrote about a report from the United Nations about this high poppy cultivation rate. And then Carlotta decided, you know, I should just throw in there that President Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai in Kandahar, is a known drug trafficker. I'm just gonna put that in there, because everyone knows this and no one's saying it. So she put it in. And Karzai read that story and he said, huh, how was it that 2 days ago I got in a huge argument with the US ambassador and the British ambassador about spraying poppy fields, which is what the British wanted to do because poppy was leading to soaking Great Britain's streets in heroin, and so they wanted to get it. That was the most efficient way they felt to get rid of the poppy. Karzai didn't want to do it because, of course, he felt like it was poisoning, his Afghan farmers. And so they got a huge fight. And the next day, there happens to be this story. So he goes, that's what did it. The New York Times, they got summoned to the embassy and they were told to put a line in the story about my brother and go after my family. And that's what he said he knew, that they were in cahoots, that they worked together as a team. And for Ghani, it's a little different. For Ghani, it's that he feels like he should get more credit and that he's just really frustrated that you have this like, progressive technocrat, Columbia University PhD, who's the president of the country, who's done some great work and won the thing of what I just said about institutionalizing press freedoms, but yet he isn't getting kind of the praise or the credit, and now he's being totally sidelined and he's negotiating with the Taliban. So he's frustrated, and to answer your question about the Afghan journalists, they have professionalized
and, you know, become even more courageous with time so that they're able to write these stories on their own and hold their administration accountable in a way in which they used to be more reliant on the U.S. government. But the dynamics and the frustration between the two presidents and the press corps is the same, although it's like for slightly different reasons.
Okay, I have another question for you. We've talked a lot about the good and bad of press, particularly international press. What are your sources? Who are your favorite writers? Who are the people that you trust to do a good story?
That's a great question. So about the episode in particular?
No, in general.
In general?
Yeah.
I think my news diet is really shaped in the morning by our morning edition posts from NPR. So I think that they treat the news with great care, and I think the journalists there are very good. I had the good fortune of working with Rachel Martin in Kabul, who's one of the morning edition hosts, so it's great to hear her voice in the morning. The reporting who I miss is I wish CJ Shivers from New York Times wrote more. I think when, for those of you who may not know, he was in the U.S. military and served, so he's got a lot of credibility with American troops and with those working in national security, because he's not just a journalist in their eyes. He's been in combat, and you can tell that in his writing. Like, there's just a richness to it, so I really enjoyed his work. I read Washington Post, my local paper, so I read quite a bit of that from local journals, and I can't name exactly some people. But then there's also the great piece of writing I read recently. I think some of the reporting on the U.S.-Mexico border has been very good. Kevin C. for the Washington Post, and then I love a good New Yorker piece. So I think there's plenty of great writers there as well, and The Economist, of course, and of course, you know, nobody who's writing those stories.
We've got
Can I have your opinion of this new documentary, Combat Obscura, describes troops and Marines in Afghanistan, gives a very bleak picture of Afghanistan and American involvement in this endless war?
I have not seen the documentary. I actually haven't heard of it, I'm sorry. But there's been some incredibly bleak moments in the war. This war has dragged on for 17 years. I have a lot of friends who have lost good friends in it. I lost a good friend in it. I have friends who've, you know, been suffering from PTSD, friends who've really struggled since their time there. And it's war, right? It's war in a lot of pockets of the country. It's uneven. You don't have war like throughout the country. It's incredibly complex. As I said earlier, I agree that this needs to come to an end, and really the only way to confront it is with the Taliban. I've been fortunate to see also another side of U.S. engagement in the country, and it's the human rights, which I think is good for all. You know, it's good. It's better for all of us when human rights thrive worldwide. In many ways, some of the progress that's been made, especially in cities, you have what they have a pluralistic, vibrant media, more so than any other country in that region. And so what we've fought for, what we've worked for, I think is manifested in these positive ways that usually gets overshadowed by war. But yeah, it's been an enduring struggle, and it needs to come to some kind of end. And I think where everyone is just feels stuck, including President Trump, which is why he, you know, renewed troops a couple of years ago, because people feel stuck, and they're hoping that these negotiations like see to an end and see just an early withdrawal of American troops. But no, that's absolutely a truth of our time there. It's been bleak.
I was very impressed with your opening comment about how American journalists present facts to American people. And it's so obvious, and yet it's something I never really stopped and thought about before. And how are we really getting reality? We're getting a perspective, but we're not getting a diverse perspective. And I guess I'm just shocked that I knew this, but I didn't know it in a sense that shaped my reading particularly. And I guess I'm wondering, how do we make that more evident to all the people who read the newspapers or hear the news and we don't stop and think about that particular, you know, when it's so obvious, and yet in day-to-day reading and thinking, it's not there.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, Tim asked me a question about my news diet, who I read. And I think one of the things that is important for all of us is that we diversify that news diet as much as possible to get a variety of opinions, especially if we're seeking to understand something. So it's interesting to read about the world from other countries' point of views, right? Which is something that is accessible to us in this digital age. And that I encourage you to do. I do read, I read British news a lot. And I still read the Afghan news, just as old habits die hard, especially as I'm talking about Afghanistan again too. I've been reading more of that. But I think just talking about it and us realizing that we are getting a slice of what's available to us, you know. The journalists are still offering objective news, but they're inherently American and they're viewing it with a worldview.
I guess I wasn't asking so much from my personal
perspective.
But how do we get that perspective to the readers in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not thinking about it either, but just buying whatever.
I think we just need to talk about how like a diverse media diet is important and talk and just kind of confront that and call it out when we see it. News literacy right now is extremely important for a variety of reasons, right? With disinformation issues and for all of us to be educated on what exactly it is that we're consuming and what point of view it is that we're taking in. Challenging ourselves to think differently. The journalism is good. But it's a slice, right? And it's very much from an American point of view. And if we want to understand any issue, we have to challenge ourselves. And I think just the best way to get that out there is to be out there talking about it, to raise it in conversations, big and small.
In the back.
What's emerging?
Minority rights participation in Afghanistan?
Yes.
Part of what I was trying to get at by talking about kind of a vibrant civil society is these efforts to protect minority rights. If you look at the Afghan constitution, it's very much about, you know, celebrating the diversity of the country and making sure that, you know, all languages are recognized in areas in which they're dominant, and that there's other religions recognized as well. But in practice, that's hard, and that's where human rights organizations and civil society, you know, and other civil society organizations need to stand up to make sure they're protected. It's it's a treacherous time right now in Afghanistan. Kind of things are coming to a head, especially as these negotiations are playing out with the Taliban, is how are minority rights, how are women's rights going to be preserved? So I guess the simple answer is that nominally, my understanding is that they are, right? But in practice, it's extremely uneven, and it depends on where you are in the country. Who's covering it? Yes, thank you. The Afghan journalists are. You'll find in that first, some of the Afghan journalists are minorities, and that they were drawn to the work because they wanted to see themselves in the press, but they also wanted to cover their rights. So the Hazaras in particular, there's a lot of Hazara journalists. That also can create a lot of tension and threats of intimidation. So the media landscape in the country reflects the country in a lot of good ways. It reflects minorities, it reflects women, but maybe not as much as the more dominant, as men and the more dominant ethnicities. But it also reflects the power brokers in society, right? All the warlords have their own television station, which also is an interesting thing there. So who's talking about it? Normally, it's the minorities in the Afghan government who are talking about it. I believe Majid Mishal from New York Times, Pam Coswell from Washington Post had good feature stories in the last year about putting spotlights on minorities and their rights. But you really do have to look for it. It's not front and center.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. So, representative.
Thank you. Is it on? So I'm just wondering, with the ethnic situation in Afghanistan, the Pashtun are about 40%, and then you have another tribal entity. I think it's the Uzbeks that are about 30%, and then you have the Hazaras and Tajiks. So is the country so ethnically driven that it just can't be a stable situation, or do the different ethnicities get along well with one another, absent some controlling outside power, or the king, back 34 years ago, the king seemed to govern. So is it a country that can actually survive without some kind of a
benign force like a king, or yeah. No, it's definitely so. It's definitely an issue when in 2001, when during the Bonn Agreement, this kind of came to a head because you had the Taliban or Pashtun. You had several warlords who reflected the different minorities, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazaras. And then there was the question of whether or not you brought back the king who had been in exile in Rome. What they settled on, depending on who you ask, but essentially, there's different versions of how this went down, but what the final decision led by the United States was that a Pashtun leader in Karzai would be the most unifying force at the time, that he would be accepted by all. And that didn't do much to get rid of ethnic tension, obviously. And it depends, I think, about them getting along. It depends on where you are standing in the country, and it depends on the politics and dynamics. If you're in urban areas, if you're like in Kabul, it's there's the minorities are very present. If you're in the south, the Pashtuns are very present. If you're in the north, you're in the center of the country, the Hazaras are, and if you're in the north, you know, it's Tajik or Uzbek, there's still a lot of tension with the warlords and the Afghan national security forces. There was just a fight, I think, up in the north, I forget which district, very recently, where you had a warlord who his followers, reflected his ethnicity, and they were fighting Afghan national security forces because they didn't want Kabul, sending in forces and inflicting their domain. So that's like an example of ethnic tension. There's ethnic tension in the country. It depends on where you are, how it's going. If you have people in Kabul who work together and are able to overcome it, or kind of out in the provinces where it's they find it unacceptable. It's just very many things in Afghanistan. It's just very uneven. I don't think there's a good answer.
All right, great. Well, thank you all for coming out. And thank you so much to Catherine for making the harrowing trip up today in our lovely spring weather. We are going to have an opportunity. We do have her books on sale. She will be signing them for anyone who is interested. So thank you again for coming out tonight. Quick reminder, perfect timing, Global Forum, May 19th. We have David Sanger of the New York Times coming to speak about cyber warfare. It's going to be really interesting, really exciting. So please do sign up early and often, and we hope to see you there. Thank you so much for joining us for our final Global Tipping Points of the season, and we look forward to seeing you at future events. Thanks so much.